Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The Province Sports Podcast.
Welcome to the White Towel Podcast. I'm Paul Chapman, joined this week by Ben Kuzma and Ed Willis. A reminder, as always, subscribe to us via Apple Podcasts. You'll get this content delivered to you every week, this wonderful content, I should say. Also, we do our White Towel videos on our websites, theprovince.com, vancouversun.com, and the wonderful articles written by these gentlemen here this week. Guys, let's jump right into it. Coming off the Canucks' loss to the Leafs, this team is going to lose games. There's no real streak to speak of. The team's been playing pretty well. Your impressions of where the core of this group is going?
Ted, well, or Ben? I think it's a continual evolvement. We've talked to death about the JT Miller's influence on this team as a guy who maybe had a bit of a chip on his shoulder when he was let go by Tampa because they needed to sign Point to a rich deal. I like the direction. I think a lot of it we need to understand here. There are still a lot of teaching points, a lot of learning points. The Leaf game was probably a good one. They probably deserved a better fate. I mean, Brock Besser misses three breakaways. He misses a cross-ice pass on the power play with a puck hops over his stick just as he's loading up the one-timer. I think what I love about Pettersson is his ability to engage and not just play. He will take a check and give one, and to be matched up against the Matthews line, I think said a lot about his growth and that line's growth. But, you know, within that, there are going to be some speed bumps. To hear Brock Besser talk post-game about he hasn't been playing very well, and quite frankly, one goal in the last eight games. He did have eight shots, 10 attempts against the Leafs. He was much better, but he did admit, I got to play that way every night. So it's interesting here that even a couple years in with some of these guys, there's still an evolution of teaching and learning and understanding what it means to play in tight games and try to win one.
To me, it's interesting the way the narrative around this team changes. Remember, if we go back to the start of the year, boy, are they too reliant on Pettersson's line for scoring, or where's the depth scoring going to come from? Now you look at it, Pearson's been scoring, Levo's been scoring, Jake's still on pace for 20 goals. That third line was doing really good stuff up until I decided I was going to do a story on them. Nice timing there, boys. And they kind of disappeared last night, but that's really been the least of their worries, and they're getting production from their blue line. So, you know, it goes back to it, and I think I mentioned this a couple of times. For me, one of the real big questions about this team at the start of the year is how prepared are these young guys to lead this team, and is it reasonable to expect them to lead this team into the playoffs at this stage of their careers? And we've kind of had, you know, fairly big sample size now. We're into 30 plus games, I believe. 500, and 500 in the NHL is not making the in the playoffs since October. They're 9-9-4, I believe, is what the run is. So, you know, I don't think it's time to take to the streets, but I think there's a, you know, legitimate reason for a bit of concern of the way they're trending.
Yeah, I think they are what they are, as one Cleveland coach once said. And I you speak to some good things, and it's interesting too because, you know, with a young team, it's kind of that college football mantra. You never know what these guys are going to do in a given game. They're going to do something spectacular or something you can't believe they made that dumb a play. But having said that, I remember early in the season when Quinn Hughes was finally anointed as power play one quarterback. They went 0-for-4 one night on home ice, and there we are talking to a kid who just turned 20 years old, and he's telling us to calm down. Mm. You know, we're going to be fine. We've got all the tools here. We're just learning each other's tendency. don't worry, the power play is going to be great. And it's fourth today. It scored the most goals in the NHL with the most attempts. My point is, when you get that kind of confidence and coolness from a kid who's a genuine Calder Trophy candidate, I think that kind of spreads through the room. I mean, even with the veteran contingent, look at this kid. I mean, he's got all these different elements in his game, a little bit of Housley, a little bit of Leach, a little bit of Orr, but he's that cool and that confident. And I think that's a big part of what's in play here, because they're going to have bad nights. They're going to get beat up in the third period and give up goals. But I think, as I say, they're trending in the right direction. There's still a lot of learning going on here. There's still a lot of teaching. Are they a playoff team? We're going to find out. I mean, I have to go on the record and say that I did predict they would fall just short. And I just think that's how tough the division and the conference is.
I don't want to take social media grumbling into much account, because there's so many people who just want to be so loud and have the so-called ironic hot take. But I have seen some criticism of Horvat that he hasn't been not just scoring as much, but hasn't been as noticeable in games. Your assessments on his season so far? I mean, he obviously got off to a great start, but I will admit you don't seem to notice him as much as you were a couple of weeks ago.
I think with Horvat, the thing is he's so cognizant of his wingers and trying to get pucks to them. I mean, he did have the hat trick game in Detroit at the end of an earlier road trip, which seemed to be a leaping off point for him. But I don't know whether the asks of him are affecting his offensive game. When you've got Sutter out and you've got Beagle out, now Horvat has to take all the defensive zone faceoffs. And I talked to Beagle about this. He said, you know, that's really hard to do. You know, you go in the defensive zone, you take that faceoff, 20 seconds, you get off the ice, there's a line change. He said, when you do that throughout the entire game, it really wears on you. And I know Horvat takes a lot of pride in his ability to win draws. He's leading the league in power play efficiency in the circle. But I think a lot of the added responsibility that came with those two guys out, on top of killing penalties as well, maybe draining him a bit. So I think as they get healthy, keep him off the PK, let Beagle take some defensive zone faceoffs. I think that can make a difference.
I just wonder, like, that C is such a small thing, but it carries a lot of weight, too. And, you know, I just wonder if we're just seeing, you know, maybe a bit of a period here where he's adjusting to the responsibility, the notoriety, all those things of having to be the spokesman. I mean, I think he's been very good at it, as good as you can expect for a kid that age at this stage of his career. But I just wonder if that, on top of everything else, to me, he's still the least of their worries. I've always wondered, and it's the thing I've always wondered about Bo, is like, is he a good enough puck distributor to be that 70, 75 point centerman? Because if he is that and Pettersson is that 90 point guy, the Canucks are set there for the next 6 to 8 years. If they're not, if he's just kind of a 50 point guy, if Pettersson's 70, that's a world of difference there. So I think that's one of the things that will out here as we move forward.
What might help Bo in the long run is the fact that when you think of him, you don't think of fluidity. You think of these bull rushes and kind of ramming the puck and jamming it and getting down low. And that's where a lot of goals are scored in today's game. You look at the one that Leivel jammed in last in the Toronto game. It was very much that. They're all around the top of the crease area because they couldn't beat Anderson, who, I don't know, he came out of the blue to play a game like that. I'm good on him, but I think that has a lot to do with his game, and maybe, like I said earlier, take away some of the other responsibilities. And he can. You see, the thing with Bo, you know, he did have a partial breakaway against the Leafs. He does have that element in his game, but I just think he's wired to look for his guys, to get down low, to be that guy, to ram pucks home. If that only means 25 goals a year, so be it. I mean, maybe that's who he is.
I know hockey is no different than any other sport, as they have their own made-up language, but I've seen a couple times this week this term of a team's micro-core.
Wow.
Have you guys heard that one yet?
No, that's new. That's great.
Totally new. And just like, how is that different micro-core than the core? They're micro-core. Is that only three players? But if you want to look at that through that lens, honestly, we can talk about how good the additions of Miller and Ben and even Myers have been to this team. Ups and downs, you're right, Ben. You talked about Besser, and, you know, it's a long season. It's a grind. We know what happened to Pettersson last year. This team's in pretty good shape, aren't they? When you look at your Horvat, certainly Hughes, Pettersson, and Besser, you still have to step back and go, yeah, the foundation's there.
Yeah, it is. And it, you know, is it at its peak though right now?
No,
you know,
of
and
course
they're going
not.
No, and they're going against so many teams where their best players are in their prime years right now. You know, and I think that's one of the, you know, that's one of the big conversation points about this. It's just, I was just thinking, you know, when we were talking about this earlier, the one thing I do wonder, there is so much pressure on this team to make the playoffs this year. And it goes back to the release of Trevor Linden and Jim Benning selling ownership on this idea. We don't have to wait 4 years to, you know, to be competitive. I just wonder if that's going to start rearing its head. And if we get into February and all of a sudden they're in 10th, 11th, 12th place, does that ratchet up the pressure on Travis Green? Does that ratchet up the pressure on Benning? I think that's in there. That's kind of the elephant in the room, and it's probably premature to talk about it now. But I don't think it will be in February. But I mean, we're projecting.
You have to.
They might be fine. They might be hanging around that playoff spot, and they might even kick the door down by the end of April. But I think with the, you know, just the track record here and everything else, and you still hear things around the league about the pressure Benning's feeling and the pressure pressure Green's feeling.
Funnily enough, I was going to ask you guys about this, and I know in particular, Ed, you've expressed your opinions of the ownership here on several occasions, and there's been pushback. Maybe it's just a new toy of his, but the social media tweeting of games by the owner is him, you know, and he's front and center in a lot of the 50th, you know, anniversary, and there's nothing wrong with that. It may be a marketing thing, but I do wonder, as the owner sort of taking on this prominence, like pushing out his message to the fans as he was doing again last night, it's sort of like now he's part of the story, and that's, you're right. If they come, and I know there's fear about this, have come the trade deadline, is there interference to maybe give up on some more future picks if you feel you want to go over the top? If there's a downside for this team, really, it is a lot of dead money and big contracts still. They're managing it because they have the young guys that are better cost, but is this just Francesco Aquilini likes to play around on social media, or do you think there's a little bit too much involvement there?
Yes, yes, and yes. All the answers are correct. He does like to play around. And I think a lot of this has to do with, I think this is Francesco Aquilini kind of trying to change his own kind of stature in the lower mainland. I remember going to training camp in Whistler and suddenly Francesco showing up and just gabbing away with us and getting the back slaps, and I'm thinking, who is this guy? And he was just maybe trying to change his image. But Paul brings up a good point here. As we get closer to the end of February and the trade deadline, where are the Canucks? I mean, the one thing I think they'd like to be is totally healthy, because maybe by the end of February, if Brandon Sutter could have stayed healthy all year and can kill penalties and win faceoffs, and some team says, you know what, if we're going to, he could really help us. You can't have enough depth in the postseason down the middle. And more importantly right now, with the injury to Michael Ferland in the Toronto game, and we were told it's an upper body injury. He threw three pretty good hits in the first period, two within a 12-second span. And what concerned me with a guy who's had multiple concussions, guys, is that whiplash effect. So is he having more symptoms? What I'm getting at is if he's on the shelf yet again, and this is a guy that Travis says we're really going to need that kind of player down the stretch. I've been pretty impressed with Zach MacEwen, who's played with some tempo and some bite. And this is going to be an interesting situation. Are they going to get to a point where they say, you know what, we need to run with Zach MacEwen. We've got something here, as opposed to leaving him in Utica all year. So I think come the trade deadline, I think it's relevant to talk about it even today. Where are they going to be and what are they prepared to do? Are they really going to push that playoff envelope, or are they going to say, you know what, we've got some guys on the horizon here. Maybe we can move this guy. Maybe we should have a more vested interest in a guy like MacEwen, who needs to get more games under him.
Yeah, I mean, it could very well be they're going to be chasing a playoff spot and be sellers at the trade deadline, too. I can totally see that. You know, we haven't even mentioned the goaltending situation, which is another kind of, you know, one of those, you know, the Raven hanging around looking down on them. And, you know, that's you know, a storyline that's going to play out here. So, and again, we look back over the last 4 or 5 years, and the pattern has been the Canucks stay, you know, they hang around, they get off to an encouraging start, and then sometimes it's November, sometimes it's December, sometimes it's even in mid-January, but eventually it's just sort of their lack of horses, the lack of talent, the other teams ramp up their game in the division, and they just fall out of contention. So, I mean, that's another thing to keep an eye on here.
When you talk to people around the league, I mean, they're super impressed by the Canucks core, but in the same tone, that they don't mention it as a this year thing.
Yeah.
They mention it as a team we have to really be wary of. They've really done some nice work in Vancouver, and eventually it'll come to fruition. I'm not so sure it's going to be this season in terms of a playoff berth when you look what's happening in the division and the conference.
We do these videos as well, and you brought up Adam Gaudette, and mm-hmm. I don't want to say he's a story that's been overlooked, because I think people recognize what a fine player he is, but when you look at the rest of this team and you look at that top-end talent and you look at the free agents, guys like Miller, they brought in Gaudette's a great piece for them to have there and fall back on, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. I mean, here's a guy who scored 30 goals, was a Hobey Baker winner, and really had to tailor his game for the NHL. He's basically one-dimensional. He played at Northeastern, and he won the Hobey Baker at a 60-point year, and he was all offense. And even when he was came up at the end of that year, you could tell right away that, boy, without the puck, it was a bit of a mystery. And the one thing that Travis Green always says about Gaudette is he sells out on every shift. And that's all you can ask as a transitioning player. And when we did our video earlier, I compared him to Alex Kerfoot, a fifth-round guy who the Canucks chased as a college free agent, chose to go to Colorado, got traded to Toronto because Colorado wanted more bite, third-line center. They got Kadri. Long story short, here you have a guy, Gaudette, a fifth-round pick that you've invested in, you drafted, you made a nice call there. If you had to choose between those two guys today, Gaudette's 2 years younger. I think he's got a bigger upside. I think he skates better. He's got a pretty good release. But more importantly, Paul, he's really learned to play without the puck, and he's gained Travis's trust to be his third-line center. And we know Sutter's on the downside here. That's one position they don't have to worry about.
Yeah, the belief in the NHL forever was you win with your two centers, your four defensemen, and your goalie. I think you can amend that now. It's your three centers now, because the game is so fast, and you need that third line to be productive. And if Gaudette is that guy, there's a couple of things here. When you're the third line guy, you never score enough that you're going to be commanding $7-8 million. So you can slide in usually at a reasonable rate. And if he can drive like a third line that does some scoring that you can match up against everybody, boy, that changes a lot of things for this team. And it looks like he's that guy now. Like I said, you know, they had that, the line with Roussel and him and Vertanen had two really, really good games, not so much last night against Toronto, but you know, in the story arc of this season, that's an important development for the Canucks. And then going forward, also, it's huge because Roussel's around for a while, Gaudette will probably be extended, and Benning will be so loath to give up on Jake, right?
His contract,
he's his guy,
right?
Yeah. So, you know, again, another thing to keep an eye on for this team.
It's what is fascinating is we went through some very lean years, obviously, in terms of when we're trying to think of what we're covering, what the storylines are in the team. And it's like we all got bored with the Sedins, not necessarily because they were the Sedins, but because there was nothing else. And I look at this team, and we've already touched on so many of them, Quinn Hughes, Besser, Gaudette. But Josh Lavo, like, that's a great story. You know, I mean, Ferland obviously is sort of the sour note. If that is a head injury, Ben, I would like to think that they're seriously talking about shutting it down, because you just can't continue to play with this. But even Roussel, like, comes back. And I know you did a great Alex Burrows piece when you're looking at the relationship that he has with Roussel. But also, I just, there's so many more parts to this team that I'm interested in than I was, say, 4 years ago.
Yeah, we're not talking about one guy or one line anymore. It's, you know, like, okay, how many Patterson stories have we done this week? You know,
exactly.
We're talking enough Quinn Hughes.
But
you bring up good points. And, you know, talking about Gaudette with the Kerfoot comparison, I just think that, you know, we got to give credit where credit's due. I mean, they addressed two issues. Top six, they had to get a couple of wingers. They needed to fix the defense. The Ferland thing concerns me. I tried to press Travis about it after the game, and they would only give it the upper body. But I think if you look closely at those hits and the whiplash effect that can be as prominent as an actual blow when you've had multiple concussions, that's a concern. And that's a guy that they purposely went out and got. They thought he could revert to 20-goal form that he had in Calgary. And really, they've given him every opportunity. He was slow to gain traction, and now he's run into concussion problems. So, but again, with that comes opportunity. And I'll bring up Zach McEwen's name again. I think the kid has taken – again, this speaks to the organization. He was super raw kid, undrafted. I mean, but he just – again,
well, they have legit options now.
Yeah, legit. Yeah. When they recall a guy, he can actually play at this level. It's not like, why did they recall this guy? Or, you know, sorry, you know, Goldobin, maybe one last chance, we'll have a look at you. Or Sven Berchi or whoever. I mean, I think those guys are, you know, fading into the sunset in terms of the organization. But at least for now, for this year, they've got some legitimate recall options.
Isn't that it's obviously a good thing, isn't it, Ed? That you, if you have those sort of fringe guys like Berchi and Goldobin, and they come up and they don't make an impact and they go back down, it just means you've got better players.
Oh, yeah, no, 100%. You know, I was thinking about this might be a really awkward comparison, but I remember when Louis Erickson came here, he was expected to provide instant offense, and when he didn't, it just affected so many things in their lineup, you know, right on down. Well, you look at it this year, they were expecting Ferland to make an impact. They were hoping Berchi would make an impact. You're probably thinking, 40 goals is not unreasonable from those two guys. It really hasn't worked out that way. Goldobin, who knew? But he was, I remember sitting here 2 years ago thinking, boy, he might be a piece going forward. And it hasn't cratered their season. In fact, I'm not sure if you can say it's had any impact on where they are in the standings. Now, you look at what Utica is, we've talked about McEwen, the defenseman, Rafferty, is quietly having a lights-out season. And I was impressed with him when they brought him up. But I'd like to see, and I'm pretty sure the way he's tracking, he's going to be seeing some NHL games this year, too. So, another guy there, and they've got another pool developing, and it's not realistic to expect all of them to hit, but you think somewhere between Tyler Madden and then the kid playing defense in Hartford and the Russian kid they took in the first round, and on and on and on, one or two of them, and that's really, they're in a position now where that's all they need. They need one or two of them to pop and become impact players.
Rafferty, Tevis, Ulevi's playing now, Rathbone. You're right, Ed. Yeah. I mean, I don't want to call it an embarrassment of riches, but you got legitimate prospects now, and defensemen. I mean, you better draft them because it costs you an arm and leg to trade for one or to get them in free agency. So they've done their due diligence there as well. And, again, this comes back to kind of a shift. I don't know when it occurred, but understanding where the game is going and the whole skill thing, whether it was the Pettersson play, or going even the Besser route or whatever, this organization understood where the game is going and they're starting to reap the awards.
In hindsight, that Pettersson pick, yeah. I don't want to say it. People were critical of it. They certainly weren't. When Thomas Green really gave his endorsement, I think, but he was a guy that wasn't talked a lot going in the draft. There were so many other names.
Yeah.
And when a couple of names that they'd been heavily linked with went before, there was this, I just remember the reaction from Canuck fans. It was like, we're going to get screwed again because, of course, they didn't get the first pick. The team, here we go. We end up with the fifth pick. Well, and yet he has almost, and the fact that he came in and stepped in at full speed, he hasn't needed 3-4 years in the minors. That to me is where this organization really started to tip forward.
Well, they really understood it at that draft because who went before Pettersson? Cale Makar. And they love Cale Makar. But it wasn't almost like we'll be damned if we're going to take another defenseman. It's just at the end of the day, as high as Makar was on their radar, they told me Pettersson was always at the top of their draft list. So again, that gets back to the point I was saying earlier, that they had the foresight that this kid is doing some incredible things that will project at the NHL level the way it's trending. So good on them.
Well, remember all the angst that was expended in this market over the draft lottery?
Yeah.
New Jersey's won it twice, yeah. Right? And they've got Nico Hischier, and Jack Hughes is going to be something special, yeah. I think, down the line. But Jersey, they're almost out of the playoff picture already. Now, if the Canucks have the first pick and they take, I don't know, I don't think they've got the stones to take Elias Pettersson first overall, or Cale Makar for that matter. So yeah, I probably would have come down between Hischier and Patrick. So it's funny the way this thing's worked out. I think you can now look at the Canucks, the way they've structured, the way they've been drafted. You give them a pass on Ulevi, and just with the depth and the core players they've drafted and brought into the system. I think that whole kind of draft question, it's at least been reframed if it hasn't been changed changed completely. And you know, to what Ben says, yeah, it's kind of up and down. It's in the NHL club. It's in Utica. It's on the reserve lift. It's everywhere in the organization.
Maybe there is such a thing as hockey gods, because when they're sitting there at the draft and Detroit's picking, and you're thinking, okay, Blashill has a connection with Quinn Hughes that goes back to the World Championship team, two Michigan guys. He absolutely loves Quinn Hughes. He couldn't stop talking about Quinn Hughes when the Canucks were in Detroit this year. What do? They pass on Quinn Hughes, and they take Zadina, who eventually may, you know, develop, but my goodness, the wave at the Canucks bench, you know, like a one-man wave, Jim Benning, they were targeting Hughes all along because they thought they were going to get Dobbs, and the way it just
played
out.
Yeah, you know, and the two Sanders that kind of jumped out of the blue.
We're compared for something else. So maybe this hockey gods thing's a real
thing. Ed, I wanted to get in a little more detail to something you referred to earlier. You said, oh, we haven't even got to the goaltending, and that's an interesting – it is an interesting situation. Yeah. I mean, what would you guys do? You've got Markstrom clearly the number one here, contract coming up. But you know you've got Demko there. You know you've got DiPietro, or if you want, there are a lot of free agent goalies that would come in and let Demko be the number one and take your 30 games on the bench or 30 games on the ice the rest of the time on the bench. Where do you see this going? And what would you recommend they do going in the offseason?
You know, well, it depends what day you ask that question. It really does. I mean, the way it looks out for this season, they just can't make a move. They can't decide. First of all, the goaltender market is always not what people think it is. It's not that richly developed. The assets you get coming back wouldn't make it worth it. So they're here now. I go back and forth in this, and I don't know. I really don't. I think, you know, Jacob Markstrom is I think he's turning 30 pretty soon, is he not?
29,
yeah, I mean, he is what he is. He's an NHL goalie. I'm just not sure if you can say he was upper tier. People were expecting. Now he's gone through a lot of stuff this year.
If he's not.
Well, yeah, I know, but where he's going with that? Last half of last season, he was. Yeah. He really was. He was a top 10 goalie, and for this team to make the playoffs this year, he's got to be at least that, and maybe even an upgrade on that. I just don't know if he is.
I think the problem is going to be term. Last time I talked to Jim Benning, of course, Jim talks, say, oh, you know what? Boy, he could play another 5, 6, 7 years. You know, goalies play into the late 30s. Well, hang on here. There's a lot of things
they used
play.
To play in the
There's a lot
the
of things
30s,
at play here. I mean, it's not just Demko's maturation, the promise of DiPietro. You got to think about the expansion draft with Seattle and protecting your goalies unless you work out some sort of a side deal. I think in a perfect world, the Canucks only maybe extend them a couple of years. And the trade-off for that is more money. If they're going to go longer, then the pullback from the team is less money. But again, that gets into the expansion issue. And I think, you know, Thatcher Demko, every time, like he's progressing quickly now. We tend to forget about last year between the concussion from friendly fire and the knee sprain. He just didn't play much, 11 games after all that. But I think that he's on this path. And DiPietro's got off to a nice start in the minors. And I just wouldn't go very long on Markstrom's deal, but I think that's going to be the debate. If you're going to less term, we want more money. More term will take less money.
The more I read about successful organizations on any multi-sport platform, they're planning a year out. So I know this time last year we were talking about it being an absolute crackerjack free agent class, and then so many of them re-signed with their current team. So have you guys looked ahead to next year? Like, if you're not going to sign Markstrom, especially if you're not going to do a shorter deal, Ben, with more money, are there players out there you think that they would be able to spend that money on?
It depends the level. If you're talking about the goaltending position per se,
I'm talking about anything. If you decide that Demko's your starter and you can fill, whether it's DiPietro or a veteran in that pure backup role, is there someone else you could spend that money on next year rather than saying, let's bring Markstrom back?
I think it's scarce to maybe go that route to say that we're going to have Markstrom on a very short leash contract-wise. I think they really believe that he's their guy. And this is why I brought up the expansion draft. Okay, that's fine to say you're sold on him and you think you got this 1A, 1B tandem that guys are pretty envious in the division. I don't think there's probably a better tandem. Then what do you do in terms of, like you said, Paul, taking that next step in free agency? Where do you go? I mean, you have to be wary of, you know, you're going to have to eventually pay Pettersson big money. You're going to have to pay Hughes big money. This is what happens when you have a young core that matures that quickly.
Well, but they've had such success in free agency.
Yeah, I know. Well, yeah.
No, yeah, and to me, they made their moves in free agency and in the trade market this offseason. I'm just not sure how many bullets he's got left to fire. As you say, they're looking at a huge payday for Pettersson.
I think it's supplementary
Hughes is maybe you fill out, but again, this is what efficient organizations do. They can fill those places from within, and I think getting back to the conversation we were having earlier, that's where the Canucks should be right now. This is Benning's fifth season on the job. There should be enough organizational depth that they can fill from within and don't have to go out getting those pieces. You know, they got Myers, they got the top four defenseman, they got the complementary piece in Ben, they traded for JT Miller, top six guy. These are significant moves. Like, these are impactful moves in the life story of the organization. I'm just not sure if there's another one out there for them again this offseason.
We'll wrap up here shortly, but I did want to ask you guys about the atmosphere in the rink. I mean, the Leafs coming to town is always a big thing, but I did read this. I mean, it could be just an oddity. It's the first time the Leafs haven't sold out here, and I think it was 8 years, maybe a bit longer.
A couple of things in play there.
I mean, yeah, absolutely, and it was still a pretty full building. I mean, it might not have been a complete sellout, but, you know, where is this team from a financial point of view right now? Obviously the 50th anniversary is a big marketing push for them. But really, like, how hot is a ticket for the Canucks if they're not selling out the Leafs?
Well, they still do that premier ticket package thing when the Leafs come to town, the original six. They charge an arm and a leg even to sit in the third deck. I talked to some people who went to the game last night, and they had to pay through the nose for that game. I think the big thing about last night, it was Tuesday night at 7 o'clock. Mm. The Leaf fans were not in the bar at Saturday at noon getting their drink on and coming to the rink at 3 for a 4 o'clock game. I mean, I really noticed in the pregame, you know, in the warm-up, you look down at the glass and it's just plastered with Leaf jerseys halfway up. That wasn't the case last night. I don't think it was so much the price point. I just think it was like it's a Tuesday night game. And, geez, the Leafs are, you know, just over a .500 team. I don't think the bloom was off the rose.
Oh, come
for,
on, Ben. The place was stuffed with Leaf fans when they were, like, but 30th in the league.
But I think a Tuesday game.
People have Christmas concerts and everything else.
But, Paul, that shouldn't be a factor. And getting back to, you know, the team and the money thing and where are they at financially, it's interesting. And a piece I did earlier, and just the way that Rogers Arena is constructed, they can't have this special VIP lounge underneath where the players march by them in a glass wall and the drinks and the food are so good they don't even go back to their seat. Everything is a view of the rink. So all the bars, special lounges that they've added so the millennials or whoever can watch the game and have their drink.
They're making avocado
really
toast on their menu yet there?
Yeah.
The Rogers Sports Bar?
Yeah, yeah. But I think the big, the kale shake? I think that's the big one. With a splash of vodka.
I think this the game Thursday night against Carolina will tell more of a story, and it was interesting. I was reading some of the Twitter feed from Edmonton where they were saying, you know, Carolina was in there, and this is the smallest crowd they can remember seeing since Edmonton moved into their new rink. So I think that'll be a story worth keeping an eye on Thursday night.
We had talked about them being home for most of December, and there are some good teams coming through. Yep. I know they've got some of the rivalry games, but you also got Pittsburgh. The Habs are coming, who are having a terrible year, but still the traditional draw. You know, Vegas is in, who I think are kind of a fun team to go see. You got Christmas, people getting tickets as presents, or they're downtown shopping. You know, I would like to think there's a good month ahead for Canuck fans.
I like the one thing I noticed early in the season, even when it was a midweek game and it wasn't a great draw, I was amazed how many people actually were there.
Yeah.
You know, especially the lower bowl where it's kind of like, you know, rattle your jewelry, you're in the expensive seats, let us know you're here. Because the third deck, they're the faithful, they're always there. I've seen that more often than not. The midweek game, not a great draw, and the building's pretty full. And again, that goes back to the kids, the younger core, the team that's entertaining, that plays at a certain pace, and more often than not, you're going to be entertained.
I just wonder, and you know, it might be my own perspective, but I just wonder if there's still a bit of a wait and see with this team. I really think this market wants to embrace this team, and they're looking for a reason to. And that's why I think this stretch of games where they've got so many at home through this month and into January is so important to sell this idea that look at what we've got, and it's just starting, and it's only going to get better. So jump on the bandwagon now. I just wonder how much much of that plays into it, because like these fans have, I mean, just think of what everything they've endured over the last four seasons. It's been, you know, the Jason Magne era. It's just been atrocious. But now they finally got something to sell, and I think people want to, but, you know, you fool me once, that kind of thing. So
what they've endured over the last 4 years, Ed, I'm going to close by talking about this project that you guys we're all doing. Yeah. With going back and looking at the top moments in the Canucks history per decade, man, was it fun. I'm looking – now we're doing the 80s, and I'm doing the research on Harry Neal going into the stands and fighting with fans and getting suspended, which opened the door for Roger Nielsen to come in, which, of course, Tal Power in 82, the run. We've talked about the uniforms, which they showed off last week. The one we ran today, Tony Gallagher wrote a spectacular profile of Richard Brodeur, where the headline was Canucks Find Spot for a Fat Man, because all he talked about was how he had the worst body in professional sports, and some jackass copy editor puts a big mug of Brodeur, and the cut line was Richard Brodeur, lumpy body. Like, number one, you couldn't get away with that now. But as bad as we look at this franchise, guys, how much fun is it looking back at some of these stories?
I went to the alumni lunch there, and that was my big takeaway, is just looking at, and it was like, God, it was like the bar scene in Star Wars, the characters that were in there. I look over there, you know, there's Harold Snaps, and there's Tiger Williams, and there's, you know, Stan Smeal, and there's all the amazing characters. And I know the Canucks story really hasn't resonated far beyond the Rocky Mountains, but I still think it's I'm with you. I just love the stories, and I love the characters and everything that it entails. And that 82 team in particular, my God, what a collection of characters it was. You know, a 31-33 team, you know, two games under 500, but, you know, there they were playing against the, you know, dynastic New York Islanders for the Stanley Cup, and everything that went along that journey too. So yeah, I know the Canucks fans really, you know, they've been missing the big prize in the 50. They've been missing several big prizes in the 50-year history, but the level and the richness of the stories that this franchise routinely serves up almost, I stress, almost makes up for it.
I had great fun trying to track down Ron Settlebauer, who was a little reclusive in Burlington. But when I finally got a hold of him, he was so self-deprecating, yeah, talking about that 40-goal year and how many, you know, pucks went off his ass or whatever. But he basically told his football coach, hang on to my number because I'm not much of a hockey player. I'll be back. And for him to talk about the family's interest in Cougar shoes and how they all came over from the old Czechoslovakia, and how a factory in the Burlington area used to make parachutes for the Second World War, the heavy material, that was perfect for shoes. And it was just a great insight into how the family dynamic into entrepreneurial world was great. But then again, just him talking about that year and how he thought he probably could have scored more than 40 goals. He got his 40th in the last game of the year, but he had an injury that was really kept quiet in February. He thought, you know, maybe I could have scored 50. But I think the thing that really resonated in that interview was the self-deprecation about, you know what, I wasn't that good a player. Just things kind of happened for me that year.
You did a great job on that story, Ben, and I still love that they had a guy crack the 40-goal mark for the first time, and they traded him away for two players who had a total of two goals between them the year before, and one of them never played a game for the Canucks. And, Ed, it's so funny you say about that team, the 82 team that made it, because, yeah, we have Running Friday, the piece that sort of talks about the fight with Neal that brought Nielsen in, and in between the Chicago series and the Islanders series, Nielsen actually told James Lawton of The Sun, and he said, I couldn't really tell you if we'll be playing 500 hockey next season. At the moment, I don't really care. For me, it is enough that it's happening now when it matters most. You can be so happy with the situation, you don't want to look too hard because it might go away. After Tiger scored for us in overtime against Calgary in the first series, I rang a pal in Toronto and said, geez, it has happened. We got a team.
Wow.
And just
wow.
to think back Holy again, moroli. What did yeah, happen yeah, to yeah, that yeah. 82 team, yeah. that really was lightning in a bottle. Beyond all else.
Well, no, I just got one. You know, while we're talking about characters, so I'm knee deep in this white towel game, and this character, Butts Giroux, pops up in the middle
the
of it.
Ear.
And like, I don't think I've got room. Like, he's basically a 2,000-word story in and by himself.
Started the contest to the coach house in North Van.
Four-time world belly flop champion, professional wrestler, and he plays blues harmonica in a now, and he's in Nanaimo. So, Butts, if you're listening, I still don't know if I can call because I don't know if I can fit you in. But He's the one, the dog ear t-shirt company are the ones that prints the white towels that are the white towels that are waved for game three of the Campbell Conference final that year. And again, the best writer on his best day couldn't create a character like Butstrew, but there he is right in the middle of this story.
Absolutely. We've run out of time. I did want to get you because you did this great column on the WHA this week with the Blazers and Jim Pattison. We'll save it for another podcast. But Ed, of course, has written a book called The Rebel League on the WHA, and when you want to talk about good stories, I wanted to ask you to reference a story about a player who was smuggled out of a game in a hockey bag because police showed up during the game to arrest him. Just fantastic story, but we'll have to save that for another time.
The Ballad of Frankie Beaton.
Oh, it's fantastic. So thanks to our producer, Juanita Ng. Thanks to Ben and Ed for joining us this week. Thanks to you for listening. Again, please subscribe to us through Apple Podcasts, and we'll be back to talk more Canucks next week.